Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Flores
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, gather around the Facebook Live iPad for another episode of This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob.
And here we are. And that intro is by Douglas, is it not, Susan, our son?
Yeah, who's it was right in that bedroom.
Yeah,
he did it on a computer right there.
He's got other stuff out there, so if you're interested, check it out. Also, This Life, hashtag You Live. Find us on Twitter and Facebook, at Dr. Drew, at Rehab Bob Forrest, at This Life Podcast, our great producer, at First Lady of Love. Get on that email list. Everything, as Bob pointed out on a recent podcast, everything's at
Dr.com.
All the family of podcasts. I really want you to get on there and get the opium series. I want you to read what Michelle and I wrote about how the
I've
opium addiction
I've taken most of them.
Oh, good. Also, me and Lawrence Vaughn.
Uniquely.
Our guest is laughing.
Hold on.
She's taking a lot of them, too.
I will introduce everybody. Give me a second. I warned you guys I have a lot to get through here. Check out Midday Live, again, noon to 3, Talk Radio 790, and KGO in San Francisco. You can also hear the podcast at kbc.com and drdrew.com. Everything there. Also, my Catherine and I hosting a new health and fitness podcast called Swole Patrol. And subscribe, tell a friend. That's gaining quite a bit of traction at Swole Patrol now that I'm on this weird meat diet. But you have to listen to that podcast to hear about it. Bob, Don't Die is the podcast,
don't
right?
Die.
And one of our guests, Owen Elliott. You can follow her at Owen Elliott 1967. And you have a signing of New Mama and Papa's?
Well, no. That's just something we'll talk about. We signed a
That's the Summer of Love, 1967.
I mean, it's all about that.
I was six. I know about
it. And our other guest is Mackenzie Phillips. That's her laughter in the background there. You can follow, see her one day at a time on Netflix. BreatheLifeHealingCenters.com is where she wants you to check it out.
The History of Opioids in America, Mackenzie Phillips.
You can follow her at Mac Phillips. And now I have something to tell Mac. One of my favorite TV shows, certainly on TV right now, is Orange is the New Black.
Yes.
And Mac has a major role in the current season, and we were so excited to see you. You did such an amazing job. You play such a good junkie. Congratulations.
life imitating art, imitating life, and it's not just the drugs, the jail too.
No, Mac was fantastic. Listen.
It's so funny.
Not everyone can do what she did. And Susan, you want to talk about this, because my wife kept just going, oh my God, oh my God, she's so good. Oh my God, I can't believe how good she is. And I'm like, well.
When you had those flies crawling all over your body, I could feel your pain.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God!
So congratulations.
You can feel my pain.
Yes, congratulations. We're not going to do any spoilers and talk about what happens to Barbara, but I will just tell you, it's if you're not watching that series, it's one of the best series on television, and this particular season is highlighted by Mac's performance, which is central in the whole season. I mean, it's a key thing. So, congratulations. Was it fun?
Oh my God, I had such a blast.
Yeah.
It was really fun. I mean, you know, there are some things about it that were odd, you know, sort of mining that history of my own as, you know, a serious junkie, you know, and then, but you know, the part about it that was so great was that I walked away feeling so full of gratitude and so free.
Yeah.
You know,
because you were not.
I said you know like eight times just now, so I apologize for that right now.
Well, you know that you were not a junkie in jail. You were able to walk from it because of your sobriety, so it's a big deal.
Yes, exactly.
And it was very cool.
Am
I right that the woman that you were in the hospital bed next to was also a recovering person, the actress? She was also sensational.
Natasha Lyonne.
Yeah.
She was epic. No, she was definitely an epic addict.
You guys just nailed it. I was so happy to see that and see it accurately portrayed by both you guys, and it's just fantastic. And then recovery was sort of part of the story too, and it really interesting, very very interesting stuff. And again, as a huge fan of that show, the actresses or any of them like the characters that they play, or are they totally different? Uh oh,
we lose her?
I don't know.
Let's
you can ask that question when we
it was so hard for me when she was on that show not to, you know, she'd be coming home from tapings and I'd call her and go, oh, how did your day go today? Don't tell me too much because I know you can't tell me, but don't tell me anything, but how did it go? I mean, like, you know,
you love that show too.
Oh my God, I'm pathological about that show. When
too.
I found out she got that role, I went,
I would, if I'd known, I would insist on going down there to the set. I would just
shoot it here.
Where was it?
New York.
in that prison, in the actual prison.
It was somewhere in Queens.
I don't care. I would have found my way there. I got news for you. I would have gone. Well, Queens have those big, their big studios.
I guess it was Brooklyn, Queens. It was somewhere out there, and it was cold. It was January and cold.
So I knew that today was going to be Laurel Canyon Day. And I've been looking forward to it
because, oh, nice.
You know, I got all the stuff about the Love Fest.
Did you go to the Love Fest?
I've been to it two times.
What explain who Owen is for people that may not be familiar with you.
Grew up in Laurel Canyon. That's all you can say. In the time when Laurel Canyon was Laurel Canyon, right?
That's a pretty fair way of
putting it. Hello, yeah. Sorry about that.
No, you are not. We've been talking about you since you hung up.
Yeah. No, we're talking about Laurel Canyon for a second because these guys are just
going nuts
over Orange is the New Black.
Yeah,
I was telling them, Mac, about when you got the role and how when you were shooting, I was so like, look, I don't want to ask anything about it, but I kind of want to know, but I don't want to know, but I kind of want to know.
I know.
It was so hard.
I told
Owen helped keep me sane over the winter, over last winter in New York. You know, we were texting back and forth a lot.
Well, just, you know, had I known you were doing this, I would have actually shown up on that set. So I'm glad I did not. It would have embarrassed you. But we were talking about Laurel Canyon.
Yeah, Laurel Canyon is just, it's the center of the universe in pop culture and music. And I moved back there, and that's how Owen and I became connected. I moved back there to try to live that life that my mom had lived, that your mom had lived, that Mac's parents had lived.
Well, explain and whoever.
It doesn't exist anymore.
But Bob, explain whose parents we're talking about, who the parents are.
Explain to Mac, because I don't think that Mac really even knows the story.
A couple years ago, my mom's name was Nancy Forrest. She had me when she was 15. Her parents adopted me, and she went about the summer of love, 1967, and moved in with your mom on Stanley Drive
Owen's mom was Mama Cass.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Bob's mom moved in with
our
her.
Our moms lived together.
Can you believe that?
Well, my mom lived at the benefit of your mother.
Yeah, and to be fair, Bob at the time only knew this woman.
I thought it
was his sister that was living
I with remember her. When you found out. I remember you... During Celebrity Rehab, you were telling us the story of how your mom's really your sister. And we were like, what?
It usually blows people's minds. But what was crazy is I was being raised by her parents, and she's living in a goddamn Laurel Canyon with those goddamn hippies, right? That's your mom, according to my grandpa.
Oh, that's so funny.
And Mac, speaking of family, I've got your book in my hands. Is that still something you're promoting, High on Arrival?
High on Arrival, absolutely.
Yeah.
I want everybody to read High on Arrival and Hopeful Healing, the second book, which is a very sweet book, a very different kind of book than High on Arrival, but they're both good.
For their own purposes, yes.
And
absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
A lot of your family, Mac, sort of reacted to this book. Are things healing any better?
I am in a wonderful stage of healing. In part, thanks to Owen, Bijou and China and I and Owen, we all hang out and, you know, it's a beautiful thing, Drew. You'd be so pleased to know that we're back in contact in a real meaningful way.
Hey, to hear it, you have no idea. I know how important Bijou particularly was and how much that hurt you. And oh my God, Owen, thank you. For Mac.
Kumbaya,
yeah.
You know, well, I mean, I just
you.
Like
Kumbaya.
Well, they're
exactly.
All, you know, honestly, they're all really my sisters, if not in blood,
yeah.
In heart, if that's a possible
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
And it killed me when they were all not on a fabulous plane. So I'm really glad that they are.
And a lot of families
yeah,
go through this over much
that, so that,
more minor situations, right? And
yeah.
hold grudges unto death.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
And so we need to talk about forgiveness in this country. This country has got to start learning how to forgive and allow. And
Bob, I don't think you have many sympathetic ears. I think the currency of the day is outrage.
Yeah,
and that's all people like feeling is outrage and envy. That's it. That's all on all sides. Outrage, envy. Outrage, envy. It's all you see and feel.
And it started like Mac started sharing with me because we were all a part of the book when it came out. And the healing started a few years ago, and I was pessimistic, and then that it really did. Yeah, because people don't forgive anymore. And they and it's so beautiful that they did, and things are coming around. I always grew up in a world where, you know, time heals and people forgive, and you know,
and
then it just went into this state of hatred for the last 10, 15, 20 years, where I see people being very rigid and not allowing forgiveness.
That's narcissism,
right?
Well, I don't think people actually really understand forgiveness as the gift that it is for themselves. People think, well, if I forgive this person, I'm co-signing what they did.
Yeah.
But forgiveness isn't for the other person. Forgiveness is to give you peace. And we all have that opportunity. And I think people really misunderstand what forgiveness is and what it's for, and how it actually works and how it's a process. And it's not just like, dude, I'm sorry. You know?
Yeah.
I think people misrepresent and misunderstand the mechanism of it.
Yeah.
Well, don't you think it's fair to say sometimes we spend a lot of time, you know, when we're forgiving somebody or in an argument with somebody, you spend a lot of time in pointing right to the event. You did this, you did that, and when you know, left your socks on the floor, the bottom line.
Or whatever, yeah.
The bottom line is that
yeah.
This really pissed me off. Can we move forward? Or you know what I mean? It's like you have to go down to the bottom line of it.
But
it's
to follow your.
We're also focused on content,
right?
You know, and
that's
content
what I mean.
Really isn't that important. It's more context that I would prefer to look at.
Correct.
Rather than
right.
The contextual thing about it, rather than the actual content of it, because we could reprocess our angers and our fears and our frustrations and our resentments over and over again.
Yep.
The processing of it isn't what heals it.
Right. Precisely,
I don't think
sister.
Anyway.
Well, precisely and where I was going with it.
And if you're following your favorite TV show, that's what that's what Mac's role was about. I mean, think about it. They both experienced this thing in the restaurant. They both made claim to it, and they furious with each other. That
over all this time,
and they,
but isn't it about... Yeah.
Yeah, but how pathological that was.
Because people can really spend years and years and years in that pathology.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So,
but let's get to where
it all
started.
Well, here's the deal.
We've talked
about this, Drew, is that, you know, when you take the drugs and alcohol out of the equation, you know, it's like if you get a horse thief sober, you still have a sober horse thief.
Yeah.
You know, so mm-hmm. the war between Barb and Carol, really on Barb's end about untreated alcoholism. All she did was get rid of the substance without doing any of the work.
Yep.
And that's when you're not letting go of resentments. You're not letting go of old hurts, and you're just in justified anger and resentment.
Yep. I think that came across.
We all know how that ends up.
Oh yes. Well, we're not going to tell anybody, but
no, we're not going to say a word.
But, I mean, I'm just so excited that they're all talking. I mean,
but let's go through, because
it's been a lot of growth on everybody's part, on Mac's part, on their part. Everybody, you know.
Mac, where are you working now?
I work at Breathe Life Healing Center in West Hollywood.
Been there forever.
But you guys, I don't carry a caseload anymore. I'm more in upper management. I'm a director there now, so I have a department called Referral Relations. And so I still run groups and stuff like that, but I'm more, I guess, upper management
Mac's
is the
always,
way you would say
Mac,
it. Yeah.
Mac, like in all chemical dependency, I'm always associated with MAP. And when Drew and I think of McKenzie, we think of PRC. Do we want to get into what happened at PRC? Drew doesn't want
to. I'm not sure because I really wasn't there.
Do you have any feelings?
I read the article that came out today,
yeah.
And I knew what happened there about a month ago. I heard that the state had shut them down. So, yeah.
And it's sad. It's sad, but it, you know, our industry as a whole has got a real come to Jesus. Everybody needs to start thinking about what is right and what is ethical and what is honorable.
And why did we get into this business in the first
right.
place?
And that's
this
what I thought.
Industry in the first
Mac,
place.
That's what I thought
Mac,
we could jump off to, which
that's the question. That's a great, great way to frame it.
Look at it this way. The recovery industry is not the hotel industry. It is saying
right.
this is a spiritual way of life we're talking about. And Owen, it's sleazier than the music business.
Is it?
Yes.
That's a pretty. Mackenzie, that's a horrible thing to
is
compare.
It
really bad.
Is it sleazier than the, is than it? The music
really
business?
Bad.
Wow.
Mackenzie, you've been in both too.
I mean, at Breed, we have something called the Fair Care Promise, where we won't work with any unethical providers. We won't refer to unethical providers. And we have a standard of care and a standard of excellence with our clients and with our business that we will not step below that standard that we've set for ourselves. And there are people who are very greedy and very money hungry and aren't in this business to spread the beauty of recovery and help people get well. And you know, those people are being weeded out.
They are getting weeded out, but it's just an interesting thing that both Mac and I work in treatment, and it's, you know, I've thought about leaving the treatment industry for the last 10 years, but then I try to fight the good fight, and you can say those nice things that we do the right thing and all that kind of stuff, but we have to take responsibility for our industry. That's mm-hmm. what I think. You know, somebody has to stand up and say, no, this is wrong. And
well,
my idea was,
there needs
do
to be
it
some
right.
laws governing.
Huh?
There needs to be some
Why
laws.
Why is there no laws governing it?
I don't know, but there needs to be some, just like
because
every
nobody
other.
Nobody ever saw a need for it.
Yeah, well, no, there's nobody.
Because it was
why
so
there's
so
no law. That's
well,
it's really,
nobody,
really simple.
Well, because this is an industry that's dealing with the disenfranchised portion of society.
Exactly right.
And no one really ever gave a crap.
About right.
You know, and now we're starting to chip away at the stigma and really start looking at this as a mental health issue as opposed to a moral issue.
100%.
And so more. And more time goes by and more people are understanding that we are a huge portion of society and we have a lot to offer, but we need to be clean and sober to be able to use our gifts.
No, that's exactly it, Bob, is that there's nobody to advocate on behalf of addicts in the government. They just don't even care. And now that it's getting to be everybody, it's
but
so
I mean,
pervasive.
Didn't we fight this fight in the 80s when the president of the United States' wife said, I'm a drug addict?
Nope, she said, I'm an alcoholic.
She said she's an addict alcoholic. And by the time she founded Betty Ford, she said she was an addict.
Yeah, but I tell you, society does not look at alcoholics and addicts the same way.
You're right. See, Mac?
They just don't.
I'm going home. Mac's going to speak on my behalf the rest of the show.
So in Orange is the New Black, drug addicts are put in jail.
Yep.
Right?
They're immoral. Criminals. They're criminals. Alcoholics are just hard driving. Good old boys. Things got out of hand.
Coal mining.
Yeah.
And whiskey drinking.
And by the way, unless you're a woman, unless you're a female.
I have family like that.
Unless you're a female, then you're a lush and a slut and a vamp and all this other stuff. We have this horrible language to use on female alcoholics. But Betty Ford turned that around a bit. She turned that around. But not for addiction. Not for addiction.
I really thought it would come in an enlightened period, and then we just added on to that enlightened period. And now I just see it's going back, and the industry itself is not able to defend itself because it's not a very ethical industry.
Right. So there needs to be guidelines, more guidelines for how programs are run and stuff. And then don't forget what my profession is doing. They've never seen a recovering drug addict. So they
He loves this. A couple podcasts ago, he hasn't forgotten it.
I will
that
never
was a
forget
comment
it.
On a doctor who was on a podcast who had never met a recovering person.
Opiate addict. I said,
really?
Certainly. I go, how do you select your patients for abstinence? She goes, abstinence, that's ridiculous. And I go, what do you mean it's ridiculous? And I started talking to her. I go, have you ever met a scene a recovering opiate addict? No, impossible. Of course not.
Where does she live?
She's an addiction expert.
Yes, she's an addiction expert.
From where?
From New York City. New York City.
Big program.
Somewhere in
big program.
Alaska? Like,
and she's an excellent physician. But my peers don't see, they don't understand this disease. They don't see it in all its arcs. They just see at the front end with the medical problems, or they give them the replacement therapies. They don't understand the actual illness itself and how it affects the mind and the brain.
And that's a concept.
Well, I remember hearing you speak once, Drew, and you said, you know, 6 hours is the most training that physicians get.
Well, now they get training
disorder.
In how to prescribe magic pills and lozenges and things for addicts, because they get better with pills, don't you know?
Exactly.
They get better with pills. You know that.
Don't you know?
Yeah.
Doesn't everyone?
Everybody. Substance use disorder with a different version of the substance
that caused the disorder in the first place. It's really bad.
So let's trace where it all, let's trace where it all went wrong, because I want you guys are moms. I want you to bear with me for a second. So 12-step approach worked for five generations, Drew, not four.
Yeah.
For Bill Wilson was born in 1897.
Wow.
It worked for the people of the Jazz Age, the people of the war, the people of the post-war, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and 80s, and 90s, yep. and 2000s. So you're talking about like 80 years.
Yeah.
And now it's just stopping cold in its tracks with millennials. And they hate it. They don't even understand what you're talking about. So, and Mac, I don't know if you're having the same experience. So I started tracing back, what is different about millennials than there is about all these other generations? And it was the self-esteem movement in parenting and unconditional love movements in parenting. Now, we all grew up in conditional love households. Your merit is based on your input. Explain it, Drew. Because it can be rough and harsh if you get a C and you get yelled at or paddled or whatever. I'm not saying that. But there was conditions upon approval.
Yeah,
and now there are no conditions upon approval.
It that combined with the internet has created what I've been trying to coach Bob up on is this Dunning-Kruger phenomenon. Dunning-Kruger effect is a psychological principle. It's the kind of cognitive distortion that would have somebody stand up at American Idol and sing like shit, and then go, "Man, wasn't that great? Wasn't that great?" Because you literally don't have the cognitive experience of knowing better.
Of self-criticism
or self-assessment. And so online, they get all the feedback. They get all the information. They know everything, and they're experts. And then when you really push them on who they are, what they know, there's nothing there.
Drew,
but they don't know that.
It's even worse than that.
But that's not narcissistic tendency?
Not necessarily.
If you even suggest that they're not a good singer, they take it personally.
It's a wound.
And then,
it's a deep wound.
And then
attack.
Project out.
Attack, yes.
Projective identification. So I'm really puzzled. Mac, what are you doing at Breathe? You're getting more focused on relaxation, meditation, that sort of stuff? Because
we're basically stage one trauma treatment, and our day is spent in a therapeutic way. It's not like when I worked at another facility, I'm using air quotes, another facility as a counselor, I would sit in my office, you know, going over a client step one with them. That was part of what, you know, the counselors were supposed to do there, as opposed to allowing our clients to, you know, find 12-step or other recovery with the mentor staff in the evening after they leave the clinic.
Right.
And so we're really, you know, licensed marriage family therapist based with some certified counselors as well, but we're really based in internal family systems, you know, different type DBT, stuff like that. And as opposed to, you know, sitting around, you know, doing steps with, going over the steps with a client, basically sponsoring a client, you know, that's not working. And I'm seeing the occasional millennial who wants to go to Refuge Recovery or who wants to go to Smart Recovery, but I'm seeing a lot. I mean, and maybe it's who we treat or the demographic of who we treat that is open to a 12-step modality.
I'm wondering if the DBT is helping. I wonder if that's sort of what gets them. Because it seems like...
Yeah, I think it might be...
Do you have DBT groups?
Really helpful.
Do you have DBT groups as well?
We have DBT groups. Yeah, and we have ACT groups. And we have internal family systems. Richard Schwartz's whole thing about the different parts of self and how they step in to protect the actual self.
And you're teaching this to millennials.
It's really kind of interesting.
I can't even understand what you're talking about.
Well, to be fair.
And you believe that millennials are embracing
this. Well, she must be getting a good subset. You know what I mean?
The Harvard graduates.
Well, whatever. They're ones that are...
So explain what DBT and ACT is.
Well, go ahead, Mac. I'll let you do it.
Well, dialectical behavioral therapy is a modality that actually uses... It's not like... Drew, will you take over on this?
Well, it's
Sunday
essentially
afternoon?
It's essentially a way of helping people understand the contents of other people's minds. You know how borderlines lose track of that? that DBT helps them with that to a great extent.
And how does it work?
It's a form of cognitive behavioral therapy. It's a way of just looking at their thinking, looking at their assessing the way they're reacting to other people, and it works. It tends to work. It doesn't go away. Borderline process doesn't go away, but they tend to be able to manage some of their affects better and their perceptions of other people.
Their effects on other people.
And their perceptions of other people, too.
And you don't think the 12 steps can help people do
that? I do. I think the 12 step done properly.
But you understand what I'm saying.
Yes, I know. Done properly.
Because the 12 steps taught me that.
I know. Done properly, it should be all that. But it just tends not to be today a lot of the time. And so people sometimes need trained DBT professionals. And maybe that's a function of their personality structures that, you know, they can't get into it. They can't get initiated in the process till they've done something like a DBT professionally managed. And then
– like Montessori and then pre-K.
Right. Well, that's what,
that's what I'm saying.
But the problem is – the problem with all of this is like the people you and I used to treat, they wouldn't remember any of it. They were so out of it that they wouldn't have any recollection of any of what we were trying to do with them. So you have to get the right population in the right time frame too.
Also, we don't do detox. I mean, I remember sitting at this other facility, air quotes, with clients who were still titrating off of Valium. You know?
You're getting a well population who's ready for treatment kind of thing and motivated too. To sit through all that.
Right. We don't take anybody who's still on any meds of you know that the type of meds that Bob and I used to like.
I think Bob still likes them.
they're all
I don't know about you, Mac. I think Bob still likes them.
Around. I'm trying to figure it out. And one was our moms, our families were a part of the '60s. You're not a part of it.
No, pointing at Owen.
Right. It was love. Right? Love. And Ringo still talks about it all the
time.
And
people laugh at him. I do laugh. I do. Yeah. Personally, I laugh at him. Peace and love.
Don't laugh at him. He didn't do anything to you.
So love. And what happened was I'll tell you
what I laugh at, because he says these incredibly aggressive, hurtful, you know, malevolent things. And goes, I mean it with peace and love. It's like, dude, just be aggressive. It's fine. Don't give me the peace and love crap.
But you understand that love was an idea that came out of Laurel Canyon, out of San Francisco, that our parents embraced, right?
You mean love of the hippie sort?
I don't know that it was hippie.
Well, parse that out. What do you mean by that? That's very interesting.
Well, I mean that the idealism of that period of time.
Yeah, capitalism is evil. Love, just share with people, communal.
Free love.
See,
as
Drew
it were.
Always gets this.
Well, because
as opposed to consequential love.
Well, because it's people living in a fantasy based on their own traumas.
They were definitely living in a fantasy.
Yeah, they were creating a fantasy that was a defensive structure
but
against their traumas.
They did a good job for like 3 years. It worked.
Until
1970, it worked. 1969.
I would argue it never worked. What do you think, Owen?
I don't know.
I was too young.
You scrunched up your forehead.
Her mom died because of it.
But you've read about it. You know about it.
As a consequence of it, yeah.
I believe they were onto something, and then it got corrupted by criminals and psychopaths and greedy, and it got misinterpreted as sexual, possessive, kind of perverted. But by the time you get to 75... you got heroin addiction, swinging, and that's where Drew always loves to point at, 75.
So it's a straight course. It's a straight line to all
but
that.
But it started altruistic, you don't think?
The principle was altruistic, but the reality was sick. It was a boundaryless...
The reality was sick. People were, you know, sort of nomadic vagabonds without any real roots, and they were sort of unwashed and wasted.
But let's talk
practically. And then they had babies.
But let's talk practically. You know? My mother
and then
was...
tried to raise those children.
Wait, my mother
and
was.
We're the ones that ended up.
With the
we're the ones that ended up shooting dope in 75, Bob.
I know. That's well, right. Hold your 79.
Every hold your thought, everybody. We'll debate the exact year after we get back. Taking a quick break. Well, it's about time for athletes, trainers to report for the start of the fall season, but we are still dealing with that extreme heat. So even if you're training indoors, dehydration is a major issue for amateurs and pros. Water, sports drinks, they do not do a great job. I've known this for a long time. That's why I wanted to develop a product. Instead, Hydrolyte came along, so I strongly suggest you stay ahead of your hydration with Hydrolyte. The best way to stay hydrated is with a proper balance of sodium, glucose, and water, and Hydrolyte does this better than anything else I've tried. Everyone here swears by it, my wife, my kids, my patients. I use it if patients need rehydration. It's a way to replete hydration orally. This gets you ahead of the game, and so you can sometimes avoid hospitalization things in my experience. Hydrolyte comes in great flavors like orange, berry, and lemonade. Available as a pre-mixed drink, a powder, or my personal preference is these effervescence tablets. You simply drop in a glass of water or a bottle of water. Literally, we don't leave home without these. Compared to sports drinks, Hydrolyte delivers up to 4 times the electrolytes with 75% less sugars. Hydrolyte solutions are appropriate for all ages, and each bottle or package includes easy-to-follow instructions. This is the best hydration product out there, period, end. You can find Hydrolyte at Rite Aid or at Hydrolyte.com/Dr. Drew, D-R-D-R-E-W. And for a limited time, our listeners can save 30% on Hydrolyte. I just sent my daughter over to buy this stuff. She's like, I need Hydrolyte. I'm like, go to the website and use the code DrDrew18, D-R-D-R-E-W-18 at checkout. That is Hydralyte.com, Hydrolyte.com/DrDrew18. Use that code, get 30% off. You won't need any other hydration products. It's the best. Okay, so we're back.
Okay, so Mac was saying at 75 is when the heroin starts and all that. But I'm going to give a human example. My mother, who I thought was my sister, was 6 years and 15. She was 21 years old, walking around the Sunset Strip, and your mom took her in. She had no money. She had no job. She had no place to live. She was just a kind, lost soul. And your mother took her into your house where
that's
you were.
Such an amazing story.
That's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
It doesn't shock me because that's the kind of person that she was.
How old was your mom?
My mom was 21. She was 15 when I was born. So she was 20, maybe.
So what year do you think this was?
67.
So she would have been my mom would have been 26 years old, and if it was 67, that's the year I was born. Depends on where right. in 67.
Yeah, I don't. It was.
She
yeah.
took in a very mentally ill homeless person
when she was hugely pregnant or had a newborn at home.
Yeah.
So the sense in this is escaping.
You guys
and
are Bob, so
thank you for bringing me down.
And Bob, how did it work out?
I thought
for her
it was so friggin' lovely.
How did it work out for her mental health? For your mom's mental health?
Well, my mom met Stephen Sills and moved to his house.
Yeah, it really amplified her pathology. I mean, she spiraled out and never recovered because of all that. Now you can look at it however you want. I mean,
but
it,
I mean that
the
kind
act
of
was
compassion we all talk about wanting to have as a society, and people were putting it into practice in the mid to late 1960s.
You're right in the most perverse kind of way. If they had done it with some foundation in understanding or knowledge or intervention for on behalf of people, which is we could do that now, and we still don't. I think that's what's sick about now. Now we
look at the homeless people.
I know.
Now
we could do it properly. We don't, and that's sick, and we need, I agree with you, a big dose of what Owen's mom had. I totally agree with that.
Well,
it looks like Owen doesn't think we do.
Well, that part.
No, I think there may have been ulterior motives that we'll discuss off.
Oh, okay.
Uh-oh. See, and there was a lot of that.
My mother wasn't, you know, clean and sober her whole life, and she may have, you know.
Found a using buddy.
Yeah.
Yeah, or whatever.
Could be.
I
think Bob, your view of this is beautiful and it's very bucolic.
I'd like to stay there. Thank you for that.
I just think that it went wrong in the 70s. It went wrong in the 70s, and then we became a real strange society, and now it's just absurd. And we have to get back to some sort of basis of compassion. You know what?
I
never liked W, but he actually came up with the term compassionate conservative. Yeah. Everybody should be conservative. Independents should be compassionate.
Absolutely.
Republicans and Democrats should be compassionate.
Of course. Every
Christians should be compassionate.
Of course.
But Bob, there's no compassion in our society.
Yes, there's outrage only. That's all there is.
I just think it's funny that we are so desperate that we look back on George W. Bush
I know. Isn't that
with
crazy?
Such like, you know,
Isn't that crazy?
There was the word compassion in his platform.
But Bob, let me ask this. What do you think your mom and Owen's mom and Max's family, what do you think they were reacting to? Where did that all their stuff come from?
Well, my mom, alcoholism.
In their family.
In the family.
Okay.
And buttoned down. So you had the culture
unbuttoning
its top button.
Had anything
happened? And you had families that were, you know, when you look at Jim Morrison's dad.
Yeah.
Have you ever read the letter Jim Morrison's dad wrote to him?
Yeah.
Have you read it?
Unbelievable. And what had his dad just been through?
He was a Marine sergeant or something.
In the Second World War.
So we're talking about PTSD. Depression.
So their family all came through the Second World War with the PTSD and the depression,
right,
the translocations.
Yep.
And they grew up with that and went, I'm going to go out and be free. I don't want to be under the influence of a Marine sergeant.
Let's go be free.
But that's a reaction to the trauma of the Second World War.
100%. Yeah, I mean,
well, imagine what it's like in England. We didn't, you know, other than the soldiers.
It's really interesting you would say that because when I really started having to feel like I was researching my mom's life and started reaching back into the family and started wondering where this tremendous depression came from that we were all, you know, suffering from, like, generationally.
Yeah.
And I track it back to my great grandmother who came to the United States before the Second World War.
From?
Poland.
Oh my God! Probably on the heels of Hitler blowing through.
No. Before
pogroms.
Before
pogroms.
She comes over. She wants to marry. She comes over ostensibly to make her living, so she can go home and marry this guy who she's fallen in love with, who's from the wrong side of the tracks. She makes her living in the United States, goes back to Poland, and he's already married somebody. And so she comes back to the United States and goes into an arranged marriage. Blah blah blah. 20 years goes by. The war starts.
Yeah.
Her entire family is wiped out.
Yeah.
In the Second World War.
Yeah.
They are marched to a grave that they've dug themselves in the forest and get in it.
Wow.
Yeah,
and that's it. So then they live with that depression.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, and the PTSD and the
and
denial.
Then they raise children with that depression.
Traumas passed down then.
Of course it is.
Because you don't appreciate how many millions of people were affected by
this.
We don't think about it now. How did she
came back.
Was she an addict?
No.
Usually the addicts survive.
The alcoholics.
Right? Yeah, the alcoholics.
No, she wasn't an addict or an alcoholic. She was terrifically depressed her entire life.
Lived in New York?
She lived in New York.
Right.
It gets even worse for her. She ends up coming back to the States, like I said, going into an arranged marriage, having three kids. They grow up. They all leave home. She's still married to this guy that she's in this arranged marriage with. When he is found murdered in a motel in Baltimore, he's been rolled by a hooker.
Jesus.
So then she's really depressed. Like the depression just kept going.
That's your mom's mom or your mom's mom's mom?
My mom's mom. My mother's.
Mother's mom.
My mother's grandmother.
Yeah, yeah.
That's my great grandmother, the one that had come from Poland.
Yeah, and so your.
So not only does she lose her entire family in Poland, the guy she's been married to for 25 or 35 years is found dead in a motel room. Right?
So here we are. Right.
And you get California genes.
Somewhere along the line. No, what you get is people that just don't feel good inside and don't know why.
But how did they come up with such beautiful music?
Well, hang on.
Mackenzie's dad wrote that.
We had after the 50s, there was money and there was mobility and there was unhappiness. And so fuck that. I'm going out to California. I'll be happy. And I'm going to just be in love with love and everybody. So unrealistic, so nutty.
Be sure to wear some flowers in your hair.
Yeah. So nutty, beyond nutty. Beautiful idea, beyond nutty.
And that's why
Rinko says peace and love, peace and love, my skin crawls. But Mac, is that any close to your family's heritage?
What was your dad's grandfather like?
My dad's father was a major in the Marine Corps.
Second World War.
He spent the last years of his life after he was decommissioned drinking in the basement.
So two former military people created John Phillips and Jim Morrison.
Of course. Of course.
This is craziness.
This is the greatest, it's the greatest generation, Bob. Look what they
and
created.
They all died when they were 27.
That's why that whole idea is so bizarre. And probably most of the greatest generation probably died on Omaha Beach anyway.
It's so crazy. Listen, Gabor Mate tells this amazing story. He says that when he was an infant and the Wehrmacht was marching into Hungary, that his mother was very anxious all the time and scared. Okay. And she called the pediatrician and said, "I don't know what's wrong. Gabor is crying. There's nothing wrong. I mean, yes, they're marching down the street." And the doctor said, "All my Jewish babies are crying. They're reacting to the anxiety of the parents.
Of course.
You can feel the anxiety. If you have an anxious parent who's afraid and or angry all the time, that energy gets transferred onto the child. And then you carry that. You don't know where it came from. That's so anxious and depressed all the time?"
That's exactly right. Intergenerational transmission of trauma is a phenomenal experience.
So I wonder how much of that just ends up translating to addiction, that feeling of feeling good and feeling uncomfortable and depressed.
But I'm trying to zero in on the 60s ideas.
We're blowing it all up for you, Bob. Relax.
I know. But so
where the ideas come from?
By where did the Summer of Love come from? You're saying it came from military backgrounds, multi-generational trauma,
but money,
and
mobility.
A bunch of people moved to Laurel Canyon and said, "Fuck it, we're just going to love each other."
Money, mobility, and baby boom. Don't forget the demographics, because the babies were now teenagers, took over. There was this huge boom of young people, and the culture shifted and decided the young people were the repository of all wisdom, which was the craziest thing ever. That's where we really went off the rail. We decided that 18-year-olds know best, because they were angry about the war, and we wanted to co-sign that. We didn't want them to go. They didn't want to go to war. They had a reasonable argument about the war. They know best. We better keep listening to them. They seem to be going somewhere. That's the new generation. Remember we used to talk all the time about the generation gap? Do you remember that in the 60s?
Right. Yeah.
Generation gap. That was something that never thought of before. And that's because there were all these people traumatized, mobile, money, who didn't want to do it. Didn't want to do what their parents did and were just rebellious. And they came up with these beautiful ideas that their parents should co-sign, man. Relax, man. You're so harsh. You're so uptight, man. Right?
I'm one generation removed from that.
Right.
I kind of straddle a weird period of time in where I was born, because being born in 67, I'm that 4 or 5 years makes it
a big difference. It does, yeah.
It really does. And
when were you back in? I was 61. When were you born, McKinley?
I was 59.
Okay.
Yeah, see,
I remember it all.
I remember Kennedy getting shot.
I remember the hippies being in Palm Springs naked, and my dad thinking Laurel Canyon, where Nancy lives, has come to our town now. These goddamn hippies.
This is your dad. This is your dad who you saw over the fence swinging with his neighbors. Is that him? Same guy?
No, that's Nancy's husband.
Oh, Nancy's husband. Okay.
That's the one. That's the sister mom. That's
so
confusing. No, that's a sister mom.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
The sister mom. Yeah.
Which is the mom.
I had an aunt mom.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. My mom's sister was my mom. Yeah, my aunt mom.
But you knew about it.
Yeah, I was in on it.
It wasn't
a secret.
There was no biological confusion.
No, it was definitely.
Yeah.
So. Wow, this is so crazy, this conversation.
Because I think we're in crisis now, and if we retrace our steps to the crisis before, you'd get some insight about now. Like I told you, I'm on a media blackout. I don't watch any news. I don't read anything. I don't care. I watched Audie Murphy Western movie this morning.
Good for
it was
you.
Awful, called Texican.
Go watch Orange the New.
Instead of MSNBC or
watch
something.
Watch Orange the New Black. It'll make you happy. Well, particularly this last season.
Jail makes me nervous.
Start
still.
At the beginning,
let's get to McKenzie.
The best part's at the end.
I can't watch any jail things because I was in jail a lot.
Oh.
I just died.
Oh, this
it
will
makes
make you crazy.
Nervous.
Well,
this
then
will make
just
you
watch
crazy.
The last episode. You'll get your.
I smoked crack in jail one time. It was the worst thing to do ever.
Why?
Because you're in jail. And you're McKenzie, do you need to know why?
No, because you're in jail and you're smoking crack. That must have been awful.
It's the first bad sign.
I like the way the answer of both of you, I go, why? And the answer of both of you is, because you're in jail and you're smoking crack. Yeah.
So what's next? What's next for you?
Let's agree that, you know, crack is usually smoked in a small, airless, dark room.
To be fair.
Not with bars on the window.
Not with 100 people in it.
Yeah, the paranoia, I get it. So what's next? Yeah. Who are you asking first?
For Mackenzie, what, is she going to keep working in treatment?
I am definitely going to keep working in treatment. There's nothing that will take me out of this world. I at first, when I started acting on One Day at a Time again, and then Orange is the New Black came along, I thought to myself, people in the treatment industry are going to judge me because I can't straddle the fence. I can only be one or the other.
Oh no! You can't.
I realized that I can do both, yeah, and still be able to work for the good for my people, addicts and alcoholics who suffer. And it only raises my visibility to chip away at the stigma, the more acting work that I can do.
Yes, you will encounter some envy and jealousy here and there, but for the most part, people will back exactly what you're describing. And in doing the work is what's meaningful. The acting is just fun, then, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, I one time when I was doing Orange Is the New Black, and I had a couple of days off, so I jumped on a plane to get back in the office, and I walked in to breathe in the morning, and I ended up, you know, talking to one of the therapists, and we were talking about a particular client, and, you know, we're like, what can we do to best serve this client? And I almost burst into tears with gratitude, yeah, that this work has such gravitas and such meaning for me. Good. And I almost was like, God, I can't even believe I have to go back to New York and pretend I'm in jail, you know, because this work really calls to me every day, and I look forward to going into Breathe every day. It's kind of crazy. Who would have thought?
Where did they film that thing? It was a completely insignificant
in site. Queens, at a place called Kaufman Astoria Studios in Queens.
There are all those big studios in Queens now, mm-hmm, and Brooklyn. Yeah, is that one as you come off what, Randall Island or something? It's a huge studio. It's like Silver Cup Studio or something. But,
yeah, we shot some stuff at Silver Cup too in the Bronx.
Yep. Oh, is that? There must be another one. I don't think that's Bronx, the one I'm thinking of. But what are you up to on? What's up next?
What's up next? Well, we just finished doing a benefit in Laurel Canyon. Speaking of Laurel Canyon, that was a really cool thing. Love Street Festival. Thank you. And it was really cool. We closed down Laurel Canyon Boulevard, which had never happened before in history. So that was kind of a neat thing to.
So you were the ones I was cursing that afternoon.
Probably.
It was them.
Well, then you know what you should be cursing is all the news stations that didn't pick up on the story when they were given it by, whatever.
Weird.
So they should have at least warned people.
That's weird.
But in any event, it was a lot of fun, and the city council renamed part of Laurel Canyon Boulevard. Actually, I'm sorry, Rothdale Trail, which runs behind Laurel Canyon Boulevard, right behind the Canyon Store, renamed it Love Street after the Doors.
Jim Morrison's house is right there.
That's correct. It's in conjunction with the 50-year anniversary
which
of the release of Love Street.
That orangish one, the stone one on the right, but it burned down.
It's got a little bell in the
belfry,
as it were.
So it's a friend of mine.
Say nothing of the current resident.
Queens of mine, friend of mine, owns the house, and Elvis has been there several times, and he gets in connection with the spirit of Jim Morrison. Ah. He calls him Jim. He didn't even know who his house it was.
Elvis, your son.
Yeah,
Elvis,
he doesn't know who Jim Morrison
is.
Wow. That's a nice segue to my next podcast.
And, it's a good one. You could have Elvis on about this Jim. He just started saying Jim, when he was like 3 years old.
Wow.
And so the guy lets us go into the house. That's now Elvis is eight and into video games. He doesn't remember any of that.
Well, that house has actually been sold in the last couple of years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's a lady that lives there now.
Oh, okay.
Well, after all this, you know, the conversation about that period of history, and there is, like with every period of history, there are good things to be gleaned, right? There's definitely, they've left behind things to be enjoyed, to be appreciated,
absolutely,
to be understood. I see, you know, I was zeroing in on the parents that either dealt with the war or were in the war. And a lot of what happened on their parenting was either emotional abuse, physical abuse, mm-hmm, like you had, you were cut loose and you were sort of out there do your own thing. Then you became object of abuse by other people. And particularly if you're having emotional abuse at home, you become a candidate for abuse by neighbors and neighbors, whatever. Right. So there it was. That's the soup that created all this. And for whatever reason, the kids that came out of all that had tremendous cultural currency at the time. And I suspect that if you really – I will never know, but one of the big reasons was the next war, which is the Vietnam War. And I think that's somehow they gained their currency through that, because they were saying no more war, we want love, and that was what caught, and that became the harbinger of wisdom. Therefore, youth knows best, and off we went. Does that make sense?
But it happened in one neighborhood in Los Angeles.
Yeah, but that's the music part. To be fair, that's the music part, and you're right. It was magical from a musical
standpoint. You're talking about, just so I can describe it right. Her mom's house is off of Wonderland.
Yeah.
It
was off of Woodrow Wilson.
Woodrow Wilson. Right. And you go up, right? It goes around the top.
Off of Mulholland.
Yeah, right, but it also comes down to the bottom.
Sure.
Right.
Many different little roads.
But just let me just describe it. Joni Mitchell, Mamas and Papas, Jim Morrison, The Doors, Jimi Hendrix, all from one square mile neighborhood.
Frank Zappa.
Frank Zappa,
it's coinkydink. It's coinkydink.
You think it's coincidence?
But I think they all lived there happily ever after, as it were. I mean, it was a bitchin' place to be.
And let me argue, if you really look at the history of that canyon, Charlie Chaplin, Houdini.
Lead Belly.
Everybody's lived in that canyon. They had a creative streak.
It had a proximity to Hollywood.
Nichols Canyon has a proximity to Hollywood.
Yeah, but that's money. That's people with money. this is people who are creative. I mean, throughout for 100 years.
It was more of a clear shot, you know.
It's still that way.
I'm sure there was some sort of harmonic convergence or collective consciousness, thing like that was going on there we can't recreate.
You've been to the Houdini?
It happens when it happens.
You know who lived there? You know who lived in the Houdini mansion? Yeah. Your old friend Ricky Rack.
No way.
He lived in that house.
Oh, crazy. My God.
That's you guys, you know there is no Houdini mansion, right?
Well, there's a Houdini statue next to the house.
Well, there's a Houdini
statue. It's a guest house.
It's a little tiny house.
There's nothing on it.
It's a bunch of gardens.
We had the gentleman who owns the Houdini Mansion, Jose Luis, I don't know his last name. I'm going to be massacred for this. He generously loaned that estate to us for all of the sound checks and the rehearsals before the shows at the Love
Play Festival. It's got beautiful gardens.
The gardens are phenomenal, and a lot of the original rock work is still there, because there was a mansion there, and it burned down.
Yeah. Well, there's the mansion across the street.
That's Chaplin, isn't it?
Belongs to Rick Rubin.
Yeah, it's Rick Rubin. There's a tunnel there that went under Laurel Canyon, and now it's all broken down. Uh-huh.
They had to stop that up. I was talking to the curator that takes care of that Houdini estate, and she said they had to close that tunnel up years ago because there were just vermin and all kinds of.
to be fair, though, it's
people you knew.
It's a magical. It's a magical place. It's a magical place in the literally the ecosystem is unlike anywhere else in Los Angeles, and for whatever reason, it attracted creative types. But that having been said, Mac
We're still going.
We're still going. We've covered a lot of territory. Mac,
I think.
Thank you for joining. I'm going to call you and ask a million more questions and geek out about Orange is the New Black.
I'd love that, Drew.
All right, done and done. Owen, thank you so much for coming and sharing the stories with us. This has been I've been fascinated by this conversation. Fascinated. And
Owen's coming on my podcast next. So I don't know if Mac is, but she's probably afraid.
What's the name of your podcast?
Calling Out with Susan Pinsky.
There you go.
We're gonna have to do that Houdini house one of these days. Maybe we should go up there. Be fun. Do a field trip.
I don't think there's anything going on up there. That's the truth.
Yeah, the Jim Morrison house.
He never lived there.
Yeah.
He hung out at the guest house across the street.
Oh.
And that was it.
That was Frank Zappa's house. Tom Mix's house.
Right.
Right.
But before it was that.
See, we know the history of Laurel Canyon here, people.
All right, everybody. We're going to wrap it up. Thank you, guys.
We'll see you guys.
Bye, Matt. See you.
Bye.
We'll see you next time.
All right, that's about it for this episode of This Life. Check us out at KBC, being Lawrence Avon, 790 Midday Live Talk Radio, Monday to Friday. You can also tune in every day live via the magic of the internet at kbc.com. If you miss it, we've made it simple for you to find all the shows at drdrew.com, the Adam and Dr. Drew podcast, the Sing One I Do By Myself, Dr. Drew podcast, This Life, of course, with Bob Swole Patrol, Mike Cantho, at his new health and fitness podcast. You can find us on Twitter at This Life Podcast, at Dr. Drew, Dairy W, at Rehab Bob Forrest, and of course, our lovely producer at First Lady of Love. I think I know who that is. If you love this show, please subscribe and tell a friend. We appreciate it when you do. We'd love to hear your feedback as well. Send us a message. Join the email list at drdrew.com, drdrew.com/contact. You'll also get a weekly email from us on that. While you're at it, at drdrew.com, please support our sponsors by clicking through the banners. We only advertise products that I can get behind. So thank you for supporting them, those that support us. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.